the entire time that we have been here since last Sunday, how much I appreciate the Reverend developing the idea and putting together the idea for these blackboards. I usually like to have three when I want to study like this, and later on you'll see why. You haven't seen it yet. Later on you'll see why we need that many. But they've done a marvelous job. They write extremely well. The chalk, it stays on and it writes easily, and it's just a marvelous job. So all of you had something to do with putting them together and painting them and putting them up. I do appreciate that, as well as putting in the recording equipment and the other things you've done. And I think it's been a marvelous job, and I appreciate it. Some questions were asked today, and I won't go into the detail of the answer, but I'll suggest it to you. A question was asked about heaven. We constantly talk about going up to heaven. So they said, where is heaven? That's interesting. Which direction is it? Where, by the way, where's up? You know, if you're in Australia, some of our brethren were here not long ago, they were there not long ago, they're here tonight. Which way was up down there, by the way? South? Which way is up? North? Where's heaven? We'll answer that question. And a lot more that had to tie to it to bring a beautiful understanding of spiritual matters beyond this life. So a lot of those kind of things are going to be involved in our study later on this week. And next Sunday morning and Sunday night, we're going to delve into those matters because it's talked about by John in chapters 21 and 22. But tonight our study is chapter 9. We have a long way to go. There is just a lot to cover in this chapter. And you'll see from this chapter tonight precisely what we've been saying. You'll see it evident to you, because what we're going to do is make a continual progress forward toward our own time, as opposed to the beginning of our study. From chapter 30, the 30 A.D. timeline, we've come forward in time up to this morning. We discussed the events that took place in 476 at the fall of pagan Rome, and the continuing on to the fall of Rome proper, and the first one-third of the fall of the Roman Empire. Now, tonight in chapter 9, the first 12 verses talk about another movement, and then still verse 13 through 21 talks about a continual advance forward until we come to a time that you'll see is quite a distance from where we started and not too far in the past from where we are today. And tomorrow night and on, we'll see our coming closer and closer and closer to our time. So then, we conclude by showing that Revelation is not a thing in the world, but just a grand picture in the language of symbols telling us about what the Christian age was to be from John's point of view. I'm sure he didn't understand it all, but God told him what to say so that when these things occurred, and item by item they were unfolded, then we could look very clearly and say, that's what it is, and here's where we stand. And we haven't seen yet where we stand because we haven't come that far down through time. But we will, and I think you'll be able to vividly see where we stand in just a few more studies. Chapter 9 is a very interesting, intriguing chapter, and if you haven't yet determined that there's a God in heaven, and every evidence around us points to it, tonight you will, by all means, know there's a God, because man just cannot do what we're going to read about. So we'll plunge into verse 1. And the fifth angel of these seven angels who had the trumpet sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. Now you might well see, as we're talking about this angel, like a star fall from heaven, you're going to see that this is a him, because the pronoun is used, showing we're no doubt talking about a person. Apparently, we're not talking about a real star in the sense of a heavenly body fall, and like we will sometimes see around us outside in the night skies, but it's spoken of as a him, so we're talking about no doubt a person. And to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. The bottomless pit, as you will note later in our studies, has to do with a place where the devil and the beast have their base of operation. So this really is, symbolically speaking, of a source of evil and of condemnation and of all things bad from which emerges the power and the source and the presence of the devil. Now someday that bottomless pit is going to disappear. No, I said that wrong. Didn't put it right. Because you see, when that happens, time will have ceased, so it won't be someday. The fact is, eventually, after time is over, the bottomless pit is going to be consigned to somewhere else. But now we have to consider it because it's here. bottomless pit. You ever seen a bottomless pit? Well, we're going to describe that too in chapter 20. There's a bottomless pit, he says, and we'll find out where it is, what it is, and what's consigned there. But just now, allow us to see this is the source of all kind of evil and harm, as you'll see this in just a moment. He opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. I think we have read enough now to give us a direction as to where to look for the next event. Well, for one thing, we know that as Revelation thus far has been a constant flow of time from the beginning of Christianity forward, then what we must do is look beyond the point of where we stopped in our last chapter, chapter 8. In chapter 8, of course, we found that in 476, Rome proper was destroyed. So we know we've come to Rome. We've seen that Rome as an entity that had power and sway over the world, that one-third of it has come to an end. So we know we have come to that point in time, so we must look beyond that, probably, for the next event. Now, also, he mentions here the locusts. The locusts give us direction, too. Because you remember back in the Bible study in the past, there were locusts also on the scene. And these locusts on the scene came from where, do you recall? They came from Arabia, or from the east. You remember back at the time the children of Israel were in Egypt, and there were 13 pestilences of some kind that were inflicted upon Egypt, and one of those had to do with locusts. And the locusts came from the east, and then when God saw fit to destroy them, a strong wind blew them into the Red Sea from the west. So, since we're talking about locusts, and since we see the land of the locusts was Arabia back in those days, that may well give us a clue at what we're looking for. So as we look into world history, when we tie it in with this period of time, 476, or a little after that, and then when we begin to tie the direction in, that lets us look at something that probably is going to fit, and it does. So what we look at now is a source of an invasion of some kind of error toward God's people and toward the Roman Empire from Arabia. And also from a time element that we've already discussed as being around the 500s. He tells us here that the sun was darkened. You might turn to the book of 2 Corinthians. We may have there an indication of something that would help us understand about the darkness of the sun as spoken of here. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning with verse 3. But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not. So those who are in darkness are those who have not believed. Those in darkness are those who are not enlightened by the Word of God. He says, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, which is the image of God, should shine unto them. So that's where a real source of light comes from, is the gospel message. Those who are not concerned with reading it and obeying it, knowing what it says, are in darkness. They may see how to get out of the rain. They may see how to drive a car. They may see how to do things in a material world, but they don't see what really counts, and that is spiritual matters, which come only from the gospel of Christ. So sometimes in the New Testament, when you talk about darkness, well, of course, we're not talking about the sun or the night light. We're talking about knowledge of spiritual matters. Now, the locusts come out of this smoke, and this smoke is such that has seemed to be a barrier. But then verse 4 of our chapter tells us, as we continue on, that those who come should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their forehead. Now, God's people have already been sealed, as you well remember back in our study in the seventh seal. And the servants of God being sealed here so they would not be destroyed when the four winds blew. We're talking about God's favored people. The ones who have responded to him have been lightened by the gospel. Now, they're sealed. And the seal of their existence is evident not because of a mark or a stamp or something very, very vivid, but it's characteristic because of how they act, how they talk, what they do, where they go, their companions. Their entire spectra of their life radiates the fact that within me is Jesus Christ. You remember when Peter and John were preaching And they were brought before the council, and it was known that these were unlearned and ignorant men. In chapter 3 of Acts, the very next verse says, they perceived that they had been with Jesus. Now, if people can see in us the fact that we have been with Jesus, then that's precisely what we're talking about. The seal of Jesus Christ is evident in us if we allow Christ's presence to be seen in our lives. You don't have to tell about it. You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to ask anyone, do you see that in me? Because they will see that in you if it's there. You can't help but let it come out. So here we have those who have the very evident demonstration of Christ's presence by their simply existing in the kind of life they ought to live. Now the command of these locusts as they come is that will not hurt the grass of the earth, the green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. So this force then is going to be directed primarily against those who are not members of the Lord's church, who are not serving God as they should. And even though some of God's people may be involved in an overall way in this, the real, serious, dedicated children of God are not going to be hurt much in this invasion. And history books tell us, as they talk about this day and age, that sure enough, those who demonstrated real, sincere Christianity in their life were usually overlooked by the invasion of the Muslims as they came forth in this first time of the onslaught we're talking about. Notice again, we can identify this as the land of the Muslims because as the invasion from Germany involved the burning of things that were green, this is what they were used to, the trees, the rivers, the springs, and the valleys, and a beautiful land of Germany, on down through Switzerland and northern Italy, a lovely land there, which was a very pretty land to live in, and they burned those things because they were used to them and were not very valuable. But down in the area where these are coming from, trees and vegetation and water is extremely scarce. And so they will not destroy the source of what they really need. And so it says they're going to watch this and not destroy these things. So as the invasion from the north was pretty well illustrated by the description of what they did when the Huns came from, when the Goths came from the north, and then we can see from this invasion from the east, it must be from the land of the desert because of the description here. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. Now, this invasion is not to actually wipe away the civilization they found, but those with whom this invasion comes in contact are going to be hurt. Of course, many will be killed. But it's not going to completely annihilate the civilization, but they're going to be tormented for 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of the scorpion when he striketh a man. So again, they're not going to be annihilated, but there will be a hurt, and there'll be evidence of that punishment or pain or torment of some kind is inflicted. Now we notice here a time element. He said this is going to occur and 5 months is going to be under consideration. Now remember that because we come on that again very shortly. As we continue on, we notice some more things that are mentioned. Verse 6. And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it. It's going to be a horrible experience for those who are not serving God, but who are going to receive the brunt of this invasion. And they shall desire to die, it says in verse 6, and death shall flee from them. So it's going to be a horrible thing to endure, but they will endure. Life will go on, but some changes are going to be made. The shape of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. And that is very easy to understand because they were horses. The men from Arabia we're talking about, we'll identify that a little bit more in a moment, are the ones who were the soldiers who rode horses. This is the very area where that was a very common thing. On their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. When you talk about the faces of men, this is reality. They were men. Now, these are soldiers who were men, so naturally it has the appearance of a face of a man. And then it says they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. He's been talking in symbolic language, but at the same time, he's mentioned some things that are real, but now we see something that probably helps us describe a little bit better who we're talking about. There are some who, when they read these verses, think in terms of this being long hair on men. The hair is as the hair of women, and since that is not women's hair, but as the hair of women, they get the idea that this long hair must have been flowing, and people would see the hair and think it would look like women's hair. I don't believe that's the idea here. Now, some commentators say that, but I've been there. And I don't get that image at all. But the picture I do get very clearly, because of my experience among those Arabs, is that this is not at all hair, but it is the headdress they wear. Now, you've seen that headdress over and over and over again. Just about all the men wear it. It's a long, flowing bandana on their head. It fits across their forehead and flows down to the back. It has something that looks to you and me, as we see it on television or in magazines or something of that nature, as two bands of rope around it. Now, it's not rope as we know rope. It's made to hold the headdress down. And then as that headdress flows onto their back, it would certainly look like hair, and particularly from a distance, and particularly if they're riding a horse at high speed, there would be a flow that would give the appearance of hair. I don't particularly like what they like. That doesn't make a bit of difference to them. I'm not trying to tell you it does. But they like checkered headdresses. I've seen a lot of those over there, but mainly the ones I've seen that I enjoy seeing are white. It seems to me that it just stands out, the very clear, beautiful whiteness of these few headdresses I've seen that color. But most of them are the kind like you've seen Yasser Arafat wear as he'd come on the television. It's a checkered one. They like that for some reason. It's just something they enjoy, and most of them are checkered that way. And I asked the Arabs, why you wear these headdresses like you wear both summer and winter, the same headdress? You know, it looks to me like it'd be hot in the summertime, and perhaps in the wintertime I can see why you need to wear it. And they said, oh no. They said, we wear it all the time because it has a use in both times of the year you described. They said, in the wintertime it is very warm. We take it and we put it across our faces, and it keeps the wind and the sand from rolling onto our faces. And it gives warmth to our whole head, so it's extremely valuable in the wintertime because it covers our head. In the summertime, we cover our faces with it again. And the reason why is because it keeps the sand from rolling in our faces. And it keeps our head cool, of course. So they know a lot more about it than I do, and they worn it for centuries, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the headdresses of the Arabs, and as they ride these beautiful horses through the desert, while, of course, that headdress flows behind and gives the appearance of women's hair. As we continue on, we find that verse 9 says, and they had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron. And that, again, is exactly right, because it was in that part of the world that, for the first time, coats of mail began to be used. Now, coats of mail would be better understood if you read some of the early English history, because there you saw the knights in armor with their coat of mail, which was a woven metal fabric where a spear or a sword would not penetrate, and therefore it protected the body. And we read that in early English history, and it's lovely to read about. It seems to be a marvelous invention, but it started first back over in Arabia. And they were wearing coats of mail a long time before England ever heard of them, and this is what it's talking about, their breastplates of iron. It was not solid iron, of course, but the coats of mail. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle, and that's exactly what it was. As they came to battle, putting their horses, putting the chariots behind their horses, you hear that rumbling, roaring sound, and this, of course, describes the army that's about to invade. They had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and the power was to hurt men 5 months. Well, we have that time again, don't we? Now, this, of course, is descriptive of what would apply to many places. But as the forefront of the army inflicts the pain, of course, the source of it comes from behind and from the command and the power and the authority of the officers who are in charge, describing, of course, the scorpion, which has that power, his real source, in his tail. And it says that they hurt men 5 months. Now, when we see 5 months twice, he's probably trying to tell us something there we need to know. And we'll see that in just a moment, but don't forget it, because 5 months is important. And they had a king over them, which is the king of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. Now, these are two terms that are extremely easy to understand, because in the Greek and in the Hebrew, these mean basically the same thing. In Hebrew, Abaddon means destruction, and in Greek, the word Apollyon means destroyer. So, basically, the same word. So, whatever this is has the caption of saying it's going to be destruction, and there's going to be a destroying in this coming forth of these who are involved. We continue on, and it says now, one woe is past. So we've come to an end of this particular source. Let's see now what we're talking about. He says he has the power to hurt me in 5 months. You remember from our previous studies, and we won't go into that just now, because we will let on tonight. You remember in our previous studies that we have found that a day in Bible prophecy many times means an actual year. And as we'll discover later on tonight, an hour means a month. And sometimes in prophecy, the actual time means the actual time. You have to determine what you're talking about by the context, that is what surrounds that particular statement, as well as the time in history you are, and how history will confirm what it really means. Now in this case, we must go to history, because history tells us that at this particular time in life, there was an event that lasted exactly 5 months. Or, prophetically, whatever 5 months would equate to. At this particular time, there arose in the world a man whose name was Mohammed. He was born in a place called Mecca in 570 A.D. I was going to point out to you where Mecca was, but my map doesn't go that long. It's about down here where this knothole is. Anyway, Mecca is way down on the coast, not quite the coast, of Arabia. If you were to get your map and look at it, and it was large enough to give you some ideas, there would be a seacoast town called Jeddah. And Jeddah is where the modern airport is today, and people fly in, or used to, when Beirut was a very nice airport, they would fly in from Beirut down to Jeddah, and they would make a pilgrimage across to Mecca, and of course, if they wanted to, up to Medina as well, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Mecca is the place where Mohammed was born, and one of the very prime places of reverence for the Muslim world. Let me take a minute to tell you something. One time in Beirut, in the airport there, I was sitting and looking at everybody around, had a big, beautiful waiting room, just a monster-sized waiting room. And you could see people from all over the world, whether from India or China or America or South America or Europe, didn't matter. As long as they were Muslims, they were there. And they came to Beirut because that's the largest airport in the Middle Eastern area. And then from there, they'd take a smaller plane, go down to Jeddah. And from Jeddah, they'd make this pilgrimage across to Medina, to Mecca. And as I look at the people there, I could see all kind of dress, just anything you want to see almost was there. It was all modest. Very, very modest. Now, remember, some were absolutely white. Their entire bodies covered with white. From the heads was covering all the way to the feet. They were barefooted. And there was not anything but white. Of course, this denotes purity. I don't mean this unkindly, but I don't know what the undergarments were. Probably white, too. I think this was chosen by them for this particular purpose. And I remember as I looked around, I saw some people who were dressed in what I figured probably were chieftains from some Arab nation, from some African nation. Of course, they were Muslims. But their dress was not in white. It was not in the typical Arab dress. It was probably their native dress. And it was interesting to note that one of the men, who probably was not too bad off financially, was a very, very tall man, beautiful specimen of a man. His wife was real short and sort of squatty. And then we had a woman sitting with them, and she was tall and big, and her husband, a little small fella, just didn't fit at all. But anyway, they were there, and of course, it's amazing to look at all these people. What they were waiting for was a flight down to Jeddah. And this is required in life one time of all the Arabs, the Muslims, the people of the Islamic point of view, if they can afford it. Now, if for some reason they are financially incapable of going, they don't have to go. It's not a sin not to go. But if at all possible, you must go. And one time in their life, they must make this pilgrimage. And, of course, as they pray all over the world where they are, they determine where they are, the direction of Mecca. And every day when they pray, they turn toward Mecca, and they pray in that direction. I've seen them pray in various houses, and they determine which direction in the house to look, so they'll be looking toward Mecca when they pray. Well, we're talking about these people. And, of course, they exist today, and later on we may be able to talk about this before I leave. I have quite a few things I want to say about them as we get to the end of Revelation, if possible. And I have some things I've written lately about those. You may want a copy of that if we have time to make some. And we'll go in detail about some more of the things they believe. But here basically is what we're talking about. Mohammed was born, as we have said, in 570 A.D. Now, this is at a time when Christianity had prospered, and when Judaism also was maintaining its stern stand against Christianity, and it had become so involved once more in materialism and lack of respect toward God that they were not a very respectable people then. Mohammed was a man who apparently, from history, was born into a family where he could have had some prosperity. It appears that his grandfather and his father were in high positions. Now, back in that part of the world, they'll have sheikhs and a number of people in the nomadic way of living that have a lot of animals, and they have a certain prestige and a certain honor among them. And the family name is extremely important. I know an Arab that's a very good friend of mine, and his family name has been carried on for generations, and the firstborn son always has the middle name of his father. So that his particular name, for example, is Odi Hana Isis. His son's name is Hana Odi Isis. His grandson's name is Odi Hana Isis. They swap the first two names back and forth and do it for generations. And one of the Arabs I know has traced his line back for 900 years. All the way back, he stops with him because he had no children. They're very proud of their family names. But this particular one apparently lost out. Because you see, the star fell, and as it fell, all the glory and the illumination of it faded too. So Mohammed comes into the world with his grandfather, and his father died, and he's left without anyone to tutor him. He's left without any of what could have been a high position to enjoy. So here he is in the world as a poor fella and not much direction to go. But he begins to work for a wealthy widow who is able to maintain quite a business. She's older than he is, probably by 20 years. He begins to work for her and travels. And as he travels toward the Middle East and up toward Damascus and Antioch and a few of those kind of places where he was exposed to the outside world, he became very, very familiar with the two major religions there, other than the paganism which he was raised around. Now, one of those was Judaism. He saw among the Jews a great deal of hypocrisy. Here they were looking for a Messiah, and the Messiah came that wouldn't have him, or at least who claimed to be a Messiah. They were claiming to be followers of the law of God. They claimed to believe in the Creator named Jehovah. They believed in all those things the Old Testament talks about, in which he had learned to understand, but they were hypocritical. He became so disgusted with them, he could not possibly follow the Jewish religion. On the other hand, he saw that Christianity, which had now been in the world for 500 or a little over years, had become so corrupt by incorporating practices that were partly involving paganism. They were insincere. They were not dedicated. They were not the kind of people the Bible described them as needing to be. He could not accept Christianity. And so here, Mohammed, being disgusted with what he saw, and that's precisely the truth, because I had the same experience myself. In that part of the world, I talked to a number of people from particularly the Islamic background, as well as some Jews too. Some Christians, by the way, are claimed to be. But the Islamic people would talk to me like this. They would say, "We're not like you Christians. We don't believe in idols." And I'd think, "Idols? Do you think we serve idols?" They said, "We're not like you Christians. We don't have idols. We don't believe in serving images." And so, of course, all of a sudden it dawned on me what they were talking about. I knew I didn't believe in idols and images. I knew I didn't worship those things. They didn't know me, though. You see, what they termed as a Christian was all around me there. You go into some of the great cathedrals, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, or the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, or some of the other great buildings there. Outside, they were not very pretty. They were just common buildings. Inside, marvelous. Some of the most beautiful architecture you've ever seen. Long, curving arches and beautiful work inside. Lavishly adorned in every way. But everywhere you look, there is an image. Every window, every crevice, everywhere you look, there's a carved image of some kind. There are candles burning. As you walk in, you can buy a candle if you wish to burn while you're there. There's incense. For example, as I went down on one occasion to the Church of the Nativity, you go below the fourth level of the building, and you turn and go down into a cave, way down underneath the floor of the church. By the way, they don't have any seats there. They're all empty. You stand up. Muslims do too, by the way. That's their practice. Anyway, way down here under the floor in the cave, supposedly where Christ is born, they have a stone slab where they have an imitation manger there. But hanging from the ceiling are big obelisks that look to me like overgrown Christmas tree ornaments. And don't take my statement incorrectly, because I'll talk in Christmas here someday. But anyway, that's what they look like, big Christmas tree ornaments. You have to walk around them. They're gaudy. I can't stand the thing. It caused me to have an ill feeling about who in the world would like this kind of thing adorning a place where Christ supposedly was born. But they glory in those things, and all kind of tapestry and all kind of drawings, but particularly images and the idols. Now, that's what the Muslim sees. He can go in those places. He sees those. He say, we're not like you Christians. We don't worship idols. I know what he means. You see, and that's what Mohammed saw. He didn't know true Christianity. He didn't understand Christianity. He never saw true Christianity. And most of the people in the Middle East had never seen true Christianity. True Christianity. They don't know what it is. Real true Christianity, like you'd find right here in this building, they would respect. They'd honor. And they'd see there's something to it, because we're more like they are. We dress simply. We're not gaudy. Most of us don't smoke or drink, which they don't. They are like us in many, many, many ways. In fact, they believe in the exact God that you do. They believe in the same God the Jews do. Ironic as it may be, the Jews, the Islamic people, and the Christians all believe in exactly the same God. In fact, the Muslims believe that Jehovah formed the world. They don't call him Jehovah. They believe in Adam, in Noah, in Abraham, in Moses, in Jesus. They believe in all those. And in the Quran, which is 117 surahs, which is the way they divide their book up, and that's what it's called, the Quran tells you about some 30 men that are mentioned in our Bibles. So you see, they're very close to us in some respects. But understand that in some respects, they do not believe that Jesus is God's son. And so that's the reason they would talk to me and say, how can you expect me to believe in Jesus? For one thing, what you believe about Jesus can't possibly be true, because if Jesus is God's son, see, they know something about it. If Jesus is God's son, how can you expect me to believe that God would let him down a cross? If God formed the world, has power to sustain the world, and God is the creator of all things, sustainer of all things, would he let his own son down the cross? You see, to them that doesn't make a bit of sense. The reason is because Christianity has failed over there. And Christianity has not let them know that God did have a son. And the son did die, not because God couldn't keep him from it, but because God allowed him to do it. That's the problem of understanding. And then another thing they said was, how can you expect me to be God's son if you can't tell me who God's wife was? They're looking at it from a human point of view. But to understand those people, there's a great deal more about them than we read about, or sometimes we want to condemn because they're such an odd kind of people from us. But that's the kind of people we're talking about. We're talking about the Islamic people who are coming through. The word Islam and the word Muslim or Muslim, which is a different kind of spelling for the same word, means the same thing. In Arabic, Islam or Muslim simply means submission to God. All the word it means. And also, the Quran is simply a word that means the writings or the sayings. And they feel that God dictated this to Mohammed, and he wrote down, I had written down for him, the sayings of God. You see how simple they are? It's not really mystical after all. It's pretty simple. On the other hand, they will not call themselves Mohammedans. And if you were to call them Mohammedans, you'd offend them. Because they say Mohammed was a man. He was not divine. He was not God. He was not God's son. Mohammed was a prophet. And we call ourselves Islamic or Muslim, but we will not call ourselves Mohammedans, because that would be taking a human name. And to call them Mohammedans to their face would be like someone calling us the Campbellites to our faces. So they are unusual people, and there are certainly many good things about them that we need to know. But the fact is, at this time in history we're talking about, they are an invading force. And they're coming to and try to share with the world their belief in the fact that Jesus was a prophet, not the prophet. But Muhammad was the prophet, and they want to share with the other part of the world the fact that we have the true religion, the true belief And of course, they were sincere in what they were doing. And many people were killed because of it. In 632, they began to spread outside the borders of Arabia. Oh, I'll tell you someday about the story of Mohammed and how he made his flights to Medina and events that took place there. But suffice it to say that he died. And then in his death, his very close friend succeeded him. And the term that applies to a successor is caliph. So when you read all the caliphs in history or in today's writings, you'll merely know they are the successors of Mohammed. So he was succeeded by his friend, not his son. He was succeeded by his friend. They began to expand their territory in 634 up to Damascus. They turned around and then came back toward Jerusalem, conquered it in 637. They conquered Egypt in 638. You see the direction they're going. They were unsuccessful at this particular time in a siege against Constantinople, which now remains the capital of the Roman Empire. That was in 675. So they have divided themselves into two directions. One direction was to the west, and they began to go out this direction across North Africa, and soon took Alexandria, one of the greatest libraries in the world, existed there. But then another section of them went to the north as well and approached Constantinople. They were unsuccessful in 675 and did not take the city, but they have invaded and taken control of that part of the what we call Turkey. They continued in their advance until in 716 they again tried to attack Constantinople, and they were unsuccessful there in the north from where they were. In 711, they had gone as far as the Straits of Gibraltar. They crossed the sea there, went over into Spain, and as they went on north into Spain, they finally crossed the Pyrenees Mountains in 721. Now, this divides France from Spain. You see how they're going? Very, very quickly. They're flying through the territory, and this less in just over 50 years, they, their headdresses, and their horses, and their chariots have covered the territory from Arabia, extending north into Syria, west over into Turkey, across entire North Africa, into Spain, out of France. It's interesting to know, and I did not know this before, that Brother Moya, and I hadn't heard that in Spanish before, but I wondered, they'd ask him what his name, where his name came from. He told me that it was Basque, or the people who lived in the Pyrenees Mountains. Very interesting. I didn't realize that. So you might want to talk to him someday about his people. But the Moors, who exist today in Spain, are the descendants of this invasion of and the intermarriage of the Muslims as they came through. Brother Moya tells me that the Basque were never contaminated by the Muslims and today remain an intact and a separated people and a very independent people today. Someday I want to read about them because he has my ears perked up. Anyway, they went on into Paris, into France. And they continued on until in the year 732, they were stopped. They were stopped by a leader of an army of Roman Catholic soldiers, basically. His name was Charles Martel. This is about 130 miles southeast of Paris. Now they were stopped, and their advance could not go any farther, did not go any farther, and eventually it dwindled back down into Spain. But this is as far as they went toward the west. Now, my question is this. If Charles Martel had not been raised up by God to be effective as he had, the next step would have been where? It would have been Germany and Switzerland and Holland and Belgium across the channel to Great Britain, and who knows what would have happened. But God saw fit, as read in the clipping this morning, to stop the army at that point. He was not ready yet for Christianity, as it was known, to fade out. And a little later in our studies, you'll see why he stopped them there. And you'll see very vividly why he did not let them take Europe. They could have very easily, but he stopped them there. As we go back to the other part of the world where they were, though, we notice that they begin to have a division among themselves. Now, this is a matter of history. We're talking about roughly 750 A.D., because in our present day, you have been reading quite a bit about the division in the Muslims, those who are predominant in Iraq and Iran, and those who don't agree among themselves. Now, you have on one hand the Shiites, and the Shiites are the ones who accepted the successor of Mohammed who was not of his kin. But the Shuni are those who are the traditional ones, and after three generations of caliphs, and the third one was assassinated, then the Shunis decided they would select Ali, or the son of Mohammed, as their leader, and so they're divided in their leadership. Basically, they believe the same thing, but the one does not accept the traditional line of descent, and the other accepts only Mohammed's direct line of descent. And that's the problem in the Middle East today. That's the reason Arabs are so divided, because they're divided on their ancestry. In the meantime, this division has the result of Islam dividing between their East and the West. It removes their incentive to try to expand because of the internal troubles. The capital is moved now from Arabia up to Damascus, and then eventually up to Baghdad, which you've been reading about recently in the newspapers. And then in 782, there was a treaty signed in Constantinople. They had made several attempts to conquer Constantinople, and thus in doing so, they would have put down the capital of the existing Roman Empire. They were never able to do it, and they were not able to now. But on the throne in Constantinople was a child emperor. His mother was regent, and she signed the treaty, and thus there was a stop of the invasion because of that treaty, and Constantinople was no more attacked by the Muslims. Now watch this closely. 5 months. How long is 5 months? All right. If we take 5 months, in prophetic time, there's 30 days in a month. That amounts to 150 days. And since a day represents a year, that's a year. Now, God told us twice in the first 12 verses of chapter 9 there was going to be an invasion of 5 months. Now, look closely. They left Arabia in 632. They were stopped at Tours exactly 100 years later in 732. That was where their aggression stopped. But the peace treaty was signed in 782, exactly 150 years after left Arabia. How did John know to write that? Was he that smart? Did he look in the future? Oh, no. God told him to write that. You see why I believe in God? These books have been in existence since the first century. These things were written 700 years before they ever occurred. How did that happen? How did John know to write that? Because somebody divine told him what was going to happen and told him to write it. But as we continue on, in chapter 9, we look a little farther and find that that woe is past, and another woe now must come on the scene. The sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice in the four horns of the golden altar which is before God. Of course, you remember this is symbolic, again, because the altar burning incense had four horns, or four projections, which came out from it. And we're seeing here now again that God is viewing these things and telling us these things. And that voice said to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound to the great river Euphrates. This is relatively interesting, very, very interesting, because we read here about some angels which were bound. Can you tell me now that angels are bound? Well, I think so. We notice now that these angels are spoken of later on as not being at all good angels, but bad angels. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning with verse 14, we read these words. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. And since Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light, verse 15 says, therefore, since this is true, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as ministers of righteousness, whose end is destruction, whose end shall be according to their works. So when we talk about the four angels bound the river Euphrates, don't for a moment expect these to be God's angels. They're not. You see, they're good angels as well as bad angels. And in Revelation 12, we're going to talk about a war in heaven and certain angels being cast out of heaven. They vividly tell us that so. So these are wicked angels. These are evil angels. These are angels of the devil we find here. We're going to find in a moment they take human form, but the fact still remains these are angels spoken of here as being bound in the river Euphrates. The mouth is not large enough for me to draw the Euphrates River, but you've seen enough of those on television lately, I imagine, to know where it is. The Euphrates River is south of the Tigris. They both come down, joined together just north of the Persian Gulf. And this is north of where the joining is, north of where Ur used to be, where Abraham came from, at the eastern end of the Fertile Crescent, as it's called in world history. So here are the four angels bound in the river Euphrates. Now they have come from the east. They have come all the way toward the west, and they're bound in that river there, and there they stop. And the year they stop in is 997. Keep that in your mind. 997 is the date we're looking at. And as they cross the Euphrates River, we find that something happens to them. The four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of man. Now, you remember the first third involved the fall of Rome proper. The second third involved the fall of the southern part of the Roman Empire. So since there are three-thirds in a whole, we've already seen the fall of two of those. And now we're going to see a fall of the next one-third. And when we see a fall of the Turks, we will have done away with the Roman Empire. So now we're looking at the third part of the third section of Rome itself. And he says they have a time prepared. He mentions this as being an hour, a day, a month, and a year. Now, surely he's trying to tell us something there, so we'll write it down. An hour, a day, a month, and a year. If he's trying to tell us something, we'll find out in a few minutes apparently what it is. And he tells us they're bound in the river Euphrates. The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000. Here you have 200 million people. I was listening or reading the other day, I forget which, to something that went back into earlier years in my life, at a time when the United States had 165 million. Not long after that, we had some 225 million. I've forgotten just exactly what it is now. But can you imagine 200 million soldiers? Now, that's how many we see coming forth. And these soldiers we see come forth who stop at the Euphrates River, who are bound there for a period of time, are an enormous force. They're coming from over in the east. They're coming from beyond the Caspian Sea, over to the north, over to the area directly into the Euphrates River. And here we're going to find a monstrous horde of people that nobody can stand before. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them having breastplates of fire, and of jacinth and of brimstone. Now, if you look at the quality of these three chemicals involved, you'll see that it pictures something that has not been spoken yet in words. And the heads of the horses were the heads of lions. Now, this is, again, symbolic language. They're not real lions on top of horses' bodies, but this shows the fierceness of whoever is coming. And out of the mouth issued fire and smoke and brimstone. Who knows what fire, smoke, and brimstone have to do with? I know Audie knows. What are we talking about, Audie? Gunsmoke. Oh, how about that? Okay. Those are three elements that we had discovered, but you know, not nearly as early as God did. Nice gunsmoke. Because he mentions it here back in 96 AD, a long, long time before gunsmoke ever was used by the Western civilization. By these three, gunsmoke, or gunpowder, I should say, I don't know where I got gunsmoke, gunpowder was the third part, the last one-third part of men killed. You see, the first two have already vanished. Now the last third is going to be killed. And it says by gun smoke, by gunpowder, by the fire, by the smoke, and by the brimstone, which issued out of their mouths. So here the horses and the lions are going to bellow forth gunpowder, or the effect of gunpowder, as we see. And their power is in their mouth and in their tail. Have you ever seen a cannon bellow forth its destructive power? Now, the projectile goes out of the mouth, but what happens in the rear end of it? Great cloud, when black spider is used, a great cloud of black smoke. Not long ago, who was it? I guess they're not here tonight. Not long ago, somebody was with me, and we were watching Civil War rifles being fired. Of course, that was the sound, and there was the projectile that went forward, or the bullet, but there was a great cloud of black smoke around the two who fired them. Now, that's what happened back in those days, and that's what we're talking about here. Their power is in their mouth and their tails. Their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, and with them they do hurt. And that's a very good descriptive term of the warfare going on now. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should worship devils, and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, wood, neither can see, nor hear, nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorcerers, nor of their fornications, nor of their thefts. So here we have the consequence of those who would not turn to God. They would not repent. They would not become Christ-like and the children of God. And they would rebel. He says now they're going to be harmed by what's going to take place. Now let's see if we can rapidly find out what is happening here. And of course, get ready now to read chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13, which give us great insight of some things we've been waiting for a long, long time to see. These four angels are speaking about, so world history tells us, not the Bible, but world history tells us now that sure enough, this force which came from the east is a group of people who had the name of Turks. First time we've ever heard of that. Now we know where Turkey is. Turkey was involved in the First World War and the Second World War, recently in the conflict in the Middle East, but at that time these were not Turks. But now the Turks come through, a great horde of 200 million soldiers. As they come from lower Central Asia, they come to the Euphrates River and they stop there in 997. But later on when they cross the Euphrates River, they divide into four parts and they conquer that part of the world. Now one part goes over to Kerman. We know it as India. The other part goes down to Persia and they conquer that. The next part comes over into Syria, which involves the Middle East and Jerusalem, that area. And the next part goes over into what at that time was called Asia, or Asia Minor as we know it, and they conquer what we know of today as Turkey. So these four angels are symbolic of the four divisions into which this great horde of soldiers divided themselves. They stayed there until 997. 60 years later, they crossed the Euphrates River, and then they completely conquered this part of the world. But it's ironic. You see, they conquered the territory which had been conquered by Islam. Islam had completely conquered the territory. They had signed a peace treaty with Constantinople so that it was not conquered yet. But Islam, the Muslims, completely controlled what we know of as Turkey. They completely controlled the Middle East. All this territory they controlled. And so when the Turks came through, the Turks just took them over. Just conquered them with no trouble at all. So the Muslims are conquered by the Turks. But it's ironic. As the Turks conquered the Muslims, listen closely. The Muslims conquered the Turks. Now, that's not a contradiction. But as the Turks conquered the Muslims, as far as physical force is concerned, the Muslims influenced the Turks to accept their religion. So you see, as they were conquered physically by the Turks were conquered by them religiously. So the Turks became Muslims. Doesn't that fall flat in the face about the lack of effect we have? If the Islamic people could conquer those who conquered them, what could we do if we had the zeal and concern the Muslims did? But that's precisely what happened. So you see, the Muslims now are effective. They're conquered people. But they are effective in that they share their religion with their Tatars, and the Turks become Muslims. And today in Turkey, you'll see the Muslim religion as a predominant and a very strong, strong force there, as well as in Persia, Iran, Syria, Arabia, and all over that part of the world. So the Muslims are still effective in conquering their conquerors. But now the overwhelming view falls to the Turks because they're the predominant power, and that's what we see come on the scene. Now it tells us that these people are to have an effect of an hour, a day, a month, and a year. Now I've told you what history says. We have read what the Bible says, but the Bible now has given us a key. And giving us a key, of course, would be very unwise if we didn't read what it had to say. He tells us something about a time element. However, before we look at the time element, I want to read you something that is taken from a letter written by a colonel who was involved in a very prominent and a very sad war in our nation. Fort Pulaski lies just to the southeast of Savannah, Georgia. It is a monstrous fort. It was built at a time when forts were effective. One of the most beautiful forts I've ever seen. One prettier than this, I suppose, in architectural design, is in St. Augustine, Florida, built by the Spaniards. This one's built by the Americans. It was engineered by a Frenchman, and it's a marvelous work. If you like building or construction or architecture, you need to see it. Marvelous work. literally thousands and thousands and thousands of bricks, and they built it on mud and sand that its fable has stood and still stands today. Monstrous fort. But before the American army could garrison it, the war came along, and the Georgia troops very quickly took it because they didn't have to fight, just marched in and took it over. So it fell into Confederate hands. And it was at that time that General Lee came down and made an inspection of it. But he had been there 30 years before as a lieutenant when he was in the Army of the United States at that time. So he served there for a while. But now the Confederates have it. It's under control of Colonel Umstreet, and they are holding it against what they think someday will be an invasion from the Union forces. What they didn't know is that the Union Army had invented a gun which had never been used before in warfare. And under cover of night, they slipped in across from Cockspur Island, 1 mile away, and they began to put fortifications on Tybee Island, silent, at night. The Confederate forces did not even dream their enemy was 1 mile away. Very effective work. They began to make the fortifications, the foundations, and all for their new cannon. And then when the time came, the very day after that night they completed their work, they opened fire on Fort Pulaski. The fire was so effective that it didn't last but one day. And into the second day, the colonel writes about the tearing of the fort, how it was just being demolished, and how there could be no hope at all of holding out even the second day. And the reason why, as he says, and so the day wore on until night brought us little rest, which was much needed, for the men were nearly worn out. He's writing his wife. On taking a survey of the fort after the firing had ceased, our worst fears were confirmed. The angle immediately opposite to the fire of the enemy was terrible, terribly shattered, and I was convinced that another day would breach it entirely. The next paragraph, his wife says that the firing continued, and that it was so intense that the magazine of the Confederate Army, where the powder was kept, was in immediate danger of exploding. And if so, the entire fort would have blown up. So he consulted with his men, and they decided that they should surrender. And they did. Of course, he was captured. And then that night, before he was taken where he thought would be New York, he wrote his wife these words: "I shall not finish this until tomorrow, when I hope to be able to tell you where we are to be sent. I care very little where it be, so long as I carry with me the approval of my own conscience. I feel that I have done my duty, my whole duty, that I have been forced to yield only to superior might of metal, guns such as have never before been brought to bear against any fortification, have overpowered me. But I trust to history to keep my name untarnished. Good night. God bless you." And he finishes the letter. Now, what he was saying very simply is this: we are forced with some guns that I had never even heard of. I didn't dream these things existed. But now there's a new weapon across a mile from me and it's tearing us apart. Now, what he later on found out, and what the Union Army was using for the first time in all history, was a rifled cannon. That simply means that inside the barrel there was a twist. And as the projectile would go out of the cannon, it would twist. It would give a great deal more power, a great deal more speed, a great deal more accuracy, and it literally tore the fort apart. And I've been around that fort and seen it. And the big gaps are still there this day. It was about to tear the fort all to pieces. From that time until now, forts have not been built. You have a fort out here, don't you? Oh, what's it? You have big walls around it? No, why not? Wouldn't do any good. In the way. Fort Benning, largest fort, I guess, in our nation, Georgia. No fort, no wall around it. You see, it made completely useless the forts as we know them. And so that gun changed the entire course of war, and our Civil War was it. But much, 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 much earlier, something else occurred. The Bible tells us it was an hour, a day, a month, and a year. We've already mentioned that something was going on there that you can relate to gunpowder. The Turks crossed the Euphrates River on 1067, having stayed there when they advanced to it for 60 years. Now they crossed,
on January the 28th, 1057, so history tells us. And finally, after attempting over and over and over again, they were able to batter down the walls of Constantinople on May the 29th of 1453. Now, what happens is that those walls around Constantinople did not give in. Did not give in to the Arabs after invasion, conquest after conquest. They were not successful. And the Turks could not do it either for almost 400 years. But finally, with the invention of the cannon, they were able to batter down those walls to where they fell. Now, that's where the gunpowder is to play here. That's where the Lord mentions for the first time gunpowder being used in battle. Now, he knew this 1400 years before it was ever done. He tells us about it right here. He describes very, very detailed the fact that we have gunpowder important warfare that battered down the walls of Constantinople, and it fell. Now, that would be sufficient in itself. That, I think, is love to know that God knew that and tells us about it through John. That would be convincing, I think, but God didn't stop there. He tells us that what we're talking about had to be for an hour, a day, a month, and a year. Now let's try to figure out what that was, and we'll see. Jesus himself said that there is 12 hours in a day. Now, of course, he's talking about daylight. So there are 12 hours in the daylight part of the day, as we well know. And he mentioned that. Now, if a day consists of what 1 year is, because a day in prophecy represents a year many times in prophecy. If a day represents 1 year and there are 12 months in a year, and we have 1 hour or 1/12 of a day, then of course 1 hour would naturally be 1 month. You follow me? There are 12 months in a year. Since a day's a year, then 1/12 of a day or 1 hour would be 1 month. Now, since we know that in prophecy a day is a year, then we'll put 1 year for the day. Then he says there is 1 month. Now, since there are 30 days in a legal month and the prophetic month, then since there are 30 days in a month, we'll put 30 days for that month to try to determine what God's telling us. Now, since there are 30 days in a month, and since a year consists of 360 days, thus we must find then that there are 12 times 30. There are 360 days in a year. Now that's the principle we've been operating on in prophecy. An hour, a day, a month, and a year would amount to 1 month, 1 day, 30 years, and 360 years. Now if we total those together, that should bring us up to what we're looking for. 1 month and 391 years. Now, that's apparently what the Bible tells us. 1 hour, a day, a month, and a year. And this is set forth to slay the third part of men. Now, since we're talking about the last one-third, so a one-third of men is going to be slain, and it has to be this time element that is involved in doing that, then apparently he's telling us how long it was that this took. Now, we determined it was 391 years and 1 month. Well, let's see. Now, history tells us that this occurred in 1057, the crossing, the capture in 1453, and it tells us the months were from January to May. Now, January to May would be 4 months. Well, let's see. Now, let's see, 7 from 13 is 6, 5 from 14 is 9, and wait a minute. History says it's 396. Did I do that right? See, 7 from 13 is 6, 5 from 14 is 9. But it's supposed to work anyway. Let's see. An hour, a day, a month, and a year. Now, an hour is 1 month, a day is 1 year, a month is 30 days, or 30 years, a year is 12 months, or 30 days, 360. That didn't work out, did it? Now, let's see. Now, history tells us it's 396. The Bible says 391. What does it do about that?
Pardon me?
You think it'll work? Well, let's try that. Now, 300 what now? Instead of 360? Well, if we put 365 here instead, well, yeah, that comes up to 396. Well, that'll work, won't it? Well, no, not quite, because we had 4 months here and 1 month over there, but it's almost. Now, this is what history says. And history has to be right because it's recording what actually took place. But God has to be right too, doesn't he? What are we going to do with those 3 months? Anybody want to suggest? Get me out of a problem. I'm stuck. What do we do? Everything we've worked so far shows that the Bible's right and agrees with history. My whole premise has been based upon the fact that Bible and history agree. Well, any time that you find an error in the Bible, what you must immediately know is this. You made a mistake. Because the Bible doesn't have any. And world history normally is right. And there's some variations. But world history is normally right because they're not involved in trying to prove anything. They're merely trying to record what has taken place. So normally, you find world history is right. And the Bible, of course, is absolutely right. So if something's wrong, you immediately know that I made a mistake. So you scratch your head and you get your clean piece of paper and pencil out and you go back again. And you say, now I know the Bible's right. It has to be right. So I must have made a mistake somewhere. Now, this is extremely important. Listen closely. In this prophecy that we find in Revelation, there's an unusual word used here, and it's the only time in the entire Bible that is ever used to relate to prophecy. The only time. Every other time it's used, it talks about something else. But the one time it talks about prophecy, it's used in a different way than any other word about prophecy relating to time. Let me see if I can give you some thoughts a minute. So, Jim, would you look up 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8? 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Jim, would you look up James chapter 5, verse 17 for me? One day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is one day. Now that's talking in general terms. He just gives us a rule of thumb and talks about a year in the sense of a period of time. Now the word used in 2 Peter for year is the word ethos, E-T-O-S in Greek. Now, what does your passage say in James 5:17? And Audie, look up Hebrews 5:27. Is it being specific there? Okay. You see, your verse was not specific. You're talking a general sense of time in general. It said a year, but a year among thousands of years. And yours was specific, exactly 3 months and six, 3 years and 6 months. Audrey, what does yours say? Hebrews 5:28, I think I asked. Let's see if I did. Well, let's see. Did I say 14? No, let's see. Hebrews 9:25. What did I say? Hebrews 9:25. Or Hebrews 9:7. Or it would be the same thing. Okay. You see, we're talking about the sacrifices in Israel, and it was talking about every year. Not talking about a year in general, or time in general, but every year being specific. Now, here's what we find. Ethos talks about a year in a general sense. Like, well, 40 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 200 years ago when a nation started, we use it in a general sense. But to be specific, you use this term, eneuthos. Eneuthos means a specific time which you have a definite count. Now, Steve was exactly right. What happens is that we have 365 years, and the only place in the entire Bible that word is used to relate to prophecy. Every other place in prophecy is a year in general. This is the one exception to that. Only one exception. But, see, let's go a little farther. We have more than 365 days in a year, don't we? How many do we have? Technically, we have 365 days, 5 hours, 48 seconds, and 48 minutes and 47 seconds. That's as close as we can get. Can't get any closer by our minds to figure it out. And what we do is just round that off to 365 one-fourth days, and that's where you can put a leap year there. But now for prophecy, let's see what we find. 365 days and a leap, and a fourth of that would be 3 months. Because a fourth of 12 months is 3 months. Now, having corrected that, let's see what we find. Do away with my scribbling here, my figuring as a human, and add it up. We have 3 months and 1 month make 4 months. We have 5 years and 1 year makes 6 years. 6 and 3 makes 9 years and 300. So we come out exactly what history says, and we could be closer. If God had told us to figure the day, there's one day difference. He didn't do that, so we don't do it. The fact is, here we find that God tells ahead of time that Constantinople is going to fall. It's going to fall by means of gunpowder, and the first time cannon was ever used in a war. He tells us it's going to be exactly from the time they cross the Euphrates River till they conquer the last third of Rome, 396 years and 4 months. You can't beat that. There's no way in this world you can get anything any closer than that. How did John know to write that? Now, you see the reason Revelation is such a marvelous book. If you read Revelation, study Revelation, there is no way you can walk out these doors and be an atheist. There's no way you can do it. You have to believe God and the truth, and you see such things as this. I didn't do this. No man did this. Almighty God, the only one could have done it. And that proves God exists. And proves to me that I must be very humble when I approach God, knowing He has the might and the power and the insight to do all these marvelous things. And we still have more to go. But what we're going to do now is see our attention turn from this, which has come to an end. You see, the first third of the Roman Empire has fallen. The second third of the Roman Empire has fallen, southern part, and now the eastern part has fallen. So that in 1453, Rome, as an imperial empire, came to an end. It exists no more. And this is the sixth head of the seven-headed beast spoken of later on in Revelation and earlier in Daniel. So we have here a certain point we've come to, and we're about now to see the seventh trumpet blow and the seven vials to be poured out on something else. But we're not ready for that yet. We've gone up to the year of 1453, but something has been going on all the time we haven't seen. And the reason we haven't seen it is because God hasn't told us about it yet. But way down low, very silently, but very positively, with a great deal of harmful effect, something has been going on, rising and growing. And we're about to see the emerging of the seventh head of that beast. And so God stops. One of the few times He stops, but He stops in prophecy and then tells us that before we continue on, we must from this year go back in time to something which has been developing way back over here in 533. So, chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13. Tell us about all this which has been going on. Then when we find it out, He proceeds further and begins to let us see the vial. So tomorrow, Lord willing, read those four chapters. I can't tell you how far we get. We have a lot to cover in those. But you'll be amazed at what we find in those four chapters. Chapter 10 through 14, if you will, tomorrow or tomorrow night. It's been so good to have you tonight. It's been a real joy to see your interest. Thank you so much for coming. But on the other hand, let me commend you, because not too many people are concerned. Too many people are concerned with ball games, television shows, things of a material world which will help them to advance with new cars, new homes. But you didn't do that tonight. You came. We appreciate you. It shows there's a quality about you that is superior to most of the world, and it's just my pleasure to be a part of such a group as you. Thanks so much for coming. May God bless you. If there's some way that we might be able to render to you tonight a spiritual service, something lacking in your life or something that you need to have strengthened, need to be baptized to Christ, whatever your need might be, to let that need be known, be our pleasure to attend to it, Lord willing, as we stand and as we sing.